Today is Monday, March 19th. We're going to wrap up the respiratory system with some more physiology today. Okay, so on page 73, pulmonary ventilation. This is just fancy language for breathing. And we talked about the two parts of breathing are inhalation and exhalation. So there's a routine of how things are going to happen here. In order for you to inhale, do your diaphragm and intercostal muscles contract or do they relax? They contract, good. When your diaphragm contracts, what happens to the shape of it?
Flattens out,
good. So it's going to flatten down toward your stomach. And your intercostal muscles contract, what change does that cause to occur to your rib cage?
Spread
it out, good. So you end up increasing your volume in your thoracic cavity thanks to the contraction of these muscles. Well, when the volume increases, what automatically happens to the pressure inside the lungs? It decreases, good. And so we have to have a pressure lower than atmospheric pressure in order for you to inhale. Why is that? Why does it have to be lower? Yeah, you can't move air in if you've got higher pressure, right? So to move air in, the pressure must be lower, and so we follow what we call a pressure gradient to move that air into our lungs. So air moves in for about 2 seconds. That allows us to get air fully moved into those alveolar air sacs. And then after that, the respiratory center in the brain stops telling us to inhale. That stops sending messages down the way of those phrenic nerves in the neck, and of course that stops stimulating the diaphragm and intercostals to contract. So when we no longer stimulate the diaphragm, it returns back up to what position? Kind of a dome shaped, okay? And when you have your intercostals relaxed, what happens to your rib cage? It comes back, yeah, to a normal position, from its flared position down to a more shrunken position, okay? So when you see those two muscle sets relax, what happens to the volume in your thoracic cavity? Decreases, right? So we end up making the thoracic cavity smaller, and anytime you shrink the volume, what happens to the pressure? Increases, good. So we've got a lot of air in a very small space now inside our lungs. Which particular pressure do we say has increased? Intrapulmonary, intrapleural, atmospheric?
What was the question again?
Which particular pressure increases when your volume decreases? Intrapulmonary, that's right. Intrapulmonary pressure will increase. Now that it is greater than your atmospheric pressure, what happens to air flow? Being expelled out of the lungs, good. So again, we're following an air pressure gradient, meaning we flow from high to low pressure, and that allows for us to move the air out of the lungs. Okay, so either it's a Monday or this is not sitting well with you.
Both.
Okay, so there's three things to keep straight of. Are my muscles contracting or relaxing? And if you can figure that out, then you can figure out, okay, if they're contracting, the volume in the thoracic cavity will increase. If those muscles are relaxing, the volume in your thoracic cavity will decrease.
Say that again.
Okay.
So if muscles contracting.
If muscles contract, volume increases. If muscles relax, volume decreases. So figure out what your muscles are doing. That's going to tell us what the volume change is. And you know that pressure is automatically opposite of volume. If volume increases, intrapulmonary pressure will decrease. Okay, and if, of course, if volume decreases, intrapulmonary pressure will increase. So if you can figure out those three things, that will help us understand which way air is going to move. If your intrapulmonary pressure is greater than, you know, or positive to your atmospheric pressure, which way does air flow? In your lungs or out? So if intrapulmonary pressure is greater than atmospheric pressure, air flows
inward.
Out. Yes, yeah, so if lung pressure is greater than atmospheric pressure, air flows out. If it's less than, you inhale. Okay? So if you can keep straight what the muscles are doing, that leads to volume changes and pressure changes. If the pressure is greater than atmospheric pressure, you exhale. So intrapulmonary pressure is greater than atmospheric pressure. You exhale. If intrapulmonary pressure is less than atmospheric pressure, you inhale. If atmospheric pressure, if intrapulmonary pressure is greater than atmospheric pressure, you exhale. And if intrapulmonary pressure is less than atmospheric pressure, you exhale. So just to repeat this from the top, in order to inhale, your diaphragm and intercostal muscles must contract. By contracting, they cause an increase in what? Volume. Good. When you increase your volume, you decrease your what?
Pressure.
Good. And since intrapulmonary pressure is the one we're decreasing, now you're lower than atmospheric pressure, and in which way does air move? Moves in. Good. So you inhale. You inhale for about 2 seconds.
So
and
you
then
inhale if it's low inside.
Low right. inside, right. yeah. And then after your diaphragm and intercostals stop contracting, you increase the increase the pressure, decrease the volume, and that's going to cause you to exhale. Okay? So it's keeping straight what the muscles are doing, what your pressure change, and what your volume change is going to be. So why don't we make a note? I'll come back and hit this one again, probably on Wednesday, just to make sure you're getting this one straight. And there's probably going to be some more things we want to come back and just redo one more time. Excuse me. Thank you. Okay, so let's hit page 74 on the bottom. That's pretty much where we left off on Wednesday of last week. Last week we were talking about how respiration affects your blood chemistry. So this particular equation came up, and this equation is actually called a buffer system. It's called the bicarbonate buffer system. And this is something we're going to explore not only in this chapter but later on in the urinary system. Blood pH has to be maintained between 7.35 and 7.45. This buffer system is a way for our body to maintain that blood pH over seconds, you know. So if we have a chemical change in the bloodstream, this system here is like a seesaw, and it can go back and forth to help maintain your blood pH within seconds of a change. Now, if we are not able to maintain blood pH within seconds, over time, within minutes, your respiratory system will say, okay, I'm going to step up and help this out because blood pH cannot continue to be changed, okay? So over, say, a few seconds, this seesaw effect here will cause your blood pH to try to get back in the normal swing of things. After minutes, your respiratory system kicks in. And after 24 hours, your very slow urinary system will finally kick on and say, okay, I'll help out too. So what we're trying to do here is look at this as a way to maintain blood pH, that very narrow range between 7.35 and 7.45. So I think of this kind of like a seesaw. You can swing to the right on this equation. You can also swing back to the left. So we do that swinging back and forth depending on what we need to do to your blood pH to make it go to 7.35 to 7.45. Okay, so we're gonna ignore any thoughts about the urinary system for right now. We're gonna focus on carbon dioxide because that is what our respiratory system can control. And the way you can control carbon dioxide in your bloodstream is either by breathing faster or by breathing slower. So we can also swing this equation to the left to make sure that we get rid of more CO2, or we can swing it to the right to make sure that we get rid of less CO2. So we can make modifications to this whole equation depending on where we need to go with your blood pH. Okay, so let's take a look closely at carbon dioxide. We know that carbon dioxide leads to bicarbonate ion in the bloodstream. This is the number one method of transport of CO2. Dissolved in our blood's plasma, that's the water here, and it breaks down into this here. We've got a hydrogen ion, and we've got a bicarbonate ion. And that bicarbonate is how we most commonly transport our CO2 in the bloodstream. I know I'm completely speaking Greek right now, right? You know, you're making grocery lists, you're thinking about everything else to do. I know I'm completely going with this chemistry stuff. Okay, so here's the issue. The more CO2 you've got, the more hydrogen ions you can put into your bloodstream. The more hydrogens you put in your bloodstream, the more acidic your bloodstream becomes. Okay, so let's kind of link this all together. The more CO2 you've got, the more hydrogen ions you'll have in your bloodstream, and the more acidic your blood becomes. Flip it the other direction. The less CO2 you've got in your bloodstream, that means there's less hydrogens and bicarbonates being transported. And ultimately, that leads to an increase in your blood pH. Let me plant this thought in your head. Are carbon dioxides the only way that you can change your blood pH? There's other stuff, right? Okay, so you may have heard of lactic acidosis. You may have heard of ketoacidosis. Those are other issues that have nothing to do with CO2, but they are increases in hydrogen ions. And so if you're in lactic acidosis, what are you probably doing?
More acid in your own blood.
You've probably got more acid in your blood as a result of
exercise.
Right. So the CO2 may not be the problem at all. It may be the fact that you're putting acid in your bloodstream from the lactic acid that's being produced through exercise. So I just want to plant that thought there, that the only way to get, or not the only way, whether to get a change in pH is carbon dioxide. You can also have hydrogen ion levels change completely separate from your carbon dioxide in your bloodstream. Let me give you another example. Does vomiting have anything to do with your CO2 levels? Not at all, right? Does having diarrhea cause you to have changes in your CO2 levels? Not at all. So your digestive system and its functions actually have no influence over your CO2, but they can change your hydrogen ion levels. So if you vomit, you actually lose hydrogens through the vomit, and that reduces the amount in the bloodstream. That can lead to what we call alkalosis. Okay, so I just want to plant that seed that there's more to it than just changes in CO2 that can lead to pH imbalances. Okay. So we're going to hang on to this thought here. This is a statement of cause and effect We are looking at CO2 leading directly to pH imbalances if you've got too much or too little in the bloodstream. So now let's talk about hyperventilation and hypoventilation as a negative feedback loop to compensate for blood pH issues. Okay, so do you recall where those chemoreceptors are located? Chemoreceptors are in your aortic arch and your carotids. Good. Aortic arch and carotids. So can you tell me what types of things your chemoreceptors are picking up on?
Chemical changes.
Chemical changes, good. One of those could be?
pH.
pH, good. Another could be? I breathe in oxygen and I breathe out. You've got it. That's what we're detecting. Okay, so we're looking at hydrogens, which lead to pH. So if I have these problems, if I have too much hydrogen in the bloodstream, if I have too many carbon dioxides in the bloodstream, or if I have too few oxygens in the bloodstream, this is going to turn on a negative feedback loop that heads to the brain with information. Go into the mountains and you have a very bad case of hypoxia, gotten to some really tall mountains. If you have hypoxia, that feedback loop goes to your brain. And what is your brain going to say about this low level of oxygen issue?
Stimulate the brain more.
Stimulate the
sympathetic nervous system.
Diaphragm. How do you stimulate the diaphragm? Which nerves come through your neck? For this case, it's actually phrenic nerves, okay? And the phrenic nerves tell your diaphragm and your intercostal muscles to contract. And if you're having low levels of oxygen, should you breathe faster or should you breathe slower?
Faster.
Yeah, breathe faster, okay? That's one thing that will turn on the hyperventilation loop. Another thing that will do it is a pH change. Let's say that you're exercising and you have a buildup of hydrogen ions due to lactic acidosis. Again, this feedbacks to the brain's respiratory center. The respiratory center says increase firing of the phrenic nerve to the diaphragm and intercostals. And in turn, what do you breathe out? CO2, good. So the more CO2 you breathe out, the more hydrogen ions you end up losing from your bloodstream. They're linked together. So the feedback loop comes back to your diaphragm and tells your diaphragm and your intercostal muscles to hyperventilate. Okay, so what does it mean to hyperventilate? Blow off more CO2, good. Breathe faster, right? Okay,
So for any of those three problems, if you have too many hydrogens and your blood is acidic, if you have too many CO2s in your bloodstream, or if you don't have enough oxygen, then we're going to have a feedback loop that turns on, same loop that we used back when we talked about blood pressure and heart rate. That feedback loop goes to your respiratory center in the brain, and the brain says, okay, lungs need to get rid of that this waste product or get in more oxygen more quickly, and hyperventilation is going to be the way to do that. So we can actually modify our breathing rate to maintain oxygen, CO2, or hydrogen ions in the bloodstream. Let's do another one. Let's say that you are exercising and producing too many CO2s. What decision is made by your respiratory center about your respiration rate? You got too much CO2. You need to breathe. Faster.
Blow off more
CO2, that's it. So if you think about when we exercise, if you climb the stairs in this building, for instance, your respiration rate increases because you're trying to blow off the CO2 and you're trying to keep your bloodstream from becoming too acidic. Okay? If you have low levels of oxygen, you breathe faster to get more into the bloodstream more quickly. So any of these three conditions here may be a way for us to maintain the proper blood gas concentrations in our bloodstream. Okay? Let's do another example using the same feedback loop. Let's say that we have a diabetic with ketoacidosis. The key word here is acidosis. What does that mean is too common in the bloodstream? Hydrogen's good. And so the feedback loop goes to your brain that says, hey, chemoreceptors told us we've got too many hydrogens. And in response, the respiratory center says we should do what? Increase respiration. Right. How does breathing faster get rid of more hydrogens? Blow off the CO2. Good. So CO2 and hydrogens are linked together. If you get rid of CO2, you're also going to get rid of hydrogen ions from your bloodstream. So anytime somebody is experiencing acidosis, they're going to breathe faster to blow off the CO2, which in turn lowers the amount of what in their bloodstream? Hydrogens, good. Gets rid of those hydrogens by blowing off that CO2. So let's flip it to the other problem. Let's say that we have too much oxygen, or maybe we have too little CO2, or maybe we have too little hydrogens in our bloodstream. So if someone, say for instance, is wearing a nasal cannula to introduce oxygen into their bloodstream, this may actually create too much oxygen, hyperoxygen in their bloodstream. So again, this is a feedback loop that sets up. Chemoreceptors pick up on this information and they tell the brain about this problem. So what do you think the brain says if there's too much oxygen? Should you breathe faster to get more in, or should you breathe slower to get less in? Breathe slower. Good. And breathing slower is called hypo. Good. That's called hypoventilation.
Why is it in the course pack underneath hyperventilation then? For excess oxygen.
Because you can hyperventilate and give yourself hypoxia. That's a cause and effect. But on page 75, it's the feedback loop.
I guess.
So you can use it. You can use hyper and hypoventilation as a feedback mechanism to fix blood pH and blood chemical issues. So that's what makes this really confusing, is that
breathing fast or hyperventilating can give you hyperoxia, but you will compensate for it by hypoventilating.
Okay.
That makes no sense, right?
No, but
we'll get there.
It's just confusing.
It is very confusing. This is probably the most confusing thing we do. Okay, so let me give you another example. If we have, you know, once again, vomiting or diarrhea, we can remove more hydrogens from the bloodstream. If we decrease the hydrogens from our bloodstream, do we run into alkalosis or acidosis?
Alkalosis,
good. And again, to keep more hydrogens, we have to actually keep more CO2. And the feedback loop comes and says to your diaphragm to breathe more slowly. So that way you end up keeping more of those hydrogens, which turn into CO2 in your bloodstream. Okay, so I think this is probably better explained by letting you guys work on some problems. This comes from page 74 and 75. Let me give you the blanks down there on 74, and then I'm going to cut you loose with some practice problems on page 76. So on the bottom of page 74, hypocapnia is fancy language. It means too little carbon dioxide. Alkalosis is too little hydrogen ions. And hyperoxia is excess what?
Oxygen.
Excess oxygen, good. So keep in mind, the bottom of page 74 is what happens when you change your respiration rate. Page 75 is actually a feedback mechanism to fix problems in your blood chemistry, whether it's oxygen, blood pH, CO2 levels. You're going to be using page 75 when you flip over to 76. There's a set of 10 feedback problems there. I'm going to cut you guys loose, and if you need my help, feel free to holler, and I'll circulate around in case you need anything. Okay, the first problem on page 76 says that we have kidney failure and a buildup of hydrogen ions in the bloodstream. And this is called metabolic acidosis because it's a metabolic issue that's causing the buildup of hydrogen ions. Out of all of that information, what I want to know is that I've got too many hydrogens. That's one of the three things that those chemoreceptors pick up on. So it looks like if you have an excess in CO or an excess in hydrogens, that's going to serve as our stimulus, okay? So what does the respiratory center there, part B, say we should do to help return blood pH to normal? Hyperventilate, good, that's increased respiration. And letter C is basically the same thing. How does the respiration rate change? It gets faster, so the respiration rate is faster. You could say we hyperventilate. Did you do okay with the first one?
No.
No. Get it backwards?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We'll keep on track and we'll see if we can get that fixed. Number two. A lot of information here. It says an overdose of antacids. You'll notice it says we have too few hydrogen ions. And also it gives you a pH, which is an alkalosis pH. So it gives you two clues there that we have not enough hydrogens and we've got an alkalosis condition. So in this situation, the stimulus is not enough hydrogens. What does the respiratory center say we should do to fix this problem?
Decrease.
Decrease, good. Decrease the respiration rate. In other words, you could say that we hypoventilate. So what is the whole purpose of hypoventilating? What are we trying to keep?
CO2.
More CO2, and CO2 basically turns into hydrogens. Yes, so CO2 makes our bloodstream become more acidic. Okay, so for number two there, the stimulus is too few hydrogens. The respiratory center compensates by decreasing or hypoventilating. And so the goal here is to keep more carbon dioxide. The more CO2 you keep, the more hydrogens you keep, and you're going to bring that blood pH back down. Do you see any problem with breathing slower and slower and slower? Not enough oxygen, right. So the brain is trying to fix the CO2 problem by breathing more slowly, but you got to be mindful that there's also an oxygen issue that could arise here. So that's something that could happen. Might not get enough oxygen if we're trying to balance out that CO2 and hydrogen issue. All right, let's see number three. We've got someone hiking and experiencing mild hypoxia. And of course, mild hypoxia means that the brain is not getting enough oxygen. So the stimulus here is low levels of oxygen or hypoxia. All right, what does the respiratory center say we should do to fix the problem? Hyperventilate, breathe faster. You knew that before you ever stepped foot in here, right? You knew that if you're hypoxic, you're gonna breathe faster. And the faster you breathe, what are you bringing more into your body? More oxygen, right. Let me make a point about number three. Does this person need to breathe faster to alter her CO2, her blood pH, or her hydrogens? Is there a problem with any of those three things? No. So the whole reason she's breathing faster has nothing to do with hydrogens, with CO2, or blood pH. The reason she's breathing faster is to get more oxygen. Okay, so when you address this on like a test, that's what you want to look for. If oxygen's your problem, then you breathe faster to get more oxygen into your system. She may not need, you know, to get more CO2 out. Her blood pH may be just fine. So we don't want to include those in the answer when they're not really the issue in the first place. How'd you do with numbers 2 and 3? Getting there? Okay, let's see that number 4. If you notice someone breathing quickly, what pH imbalance must have turned on the respiratory center to initiate hyperventilation? Acidosis, good. So if you had acidosis, too many hydrogens, then yeah, you would hyperventilate to help get rid of those CO2 molecules. Okay. So number 4, you would be, this guy probably was experiencing acidosis. All right, number 5, aspirin overdose cause a overstimulation of the respiratory center. So what the respiratory center says to the diaphragm is breathe, 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 breathe. So your respiration rate must have increased. Looking at choice A there, letter A, what blood pH imbalance is going to result from you breathing faster? You're getting too much oxygen and you're losing too many
CO2.
And the more CO2 that you lose, you get into alkalosis territory. That's right. So for number 5A, you end up with respiratory alkalosis. We use the word respiratory to imply that's the system causing the problem. Okay, so for 5A, respiratory alkalosis results because you're breathing out so many of those CO2 molecules.
Can you like explain that a little more? Because to me, like number 4 is breathing quickly and number 5 is breathing quickly. So is that how it is, or am I like breathing it wrong?
Number 4 is a compensation. Like if you walk in and see somebody breathing really fast, most people don't normally sit around and breathe really quickly unless something's causing them to breathe fast. So for number four, we're actually having to go backwards in the feedback loop. And we say, okay, why is this person breathing faster? It's either, you know, too many hydrogens, too many CO2, or low oxygen. So we're actually going backwards in the feedback loop. Number five is saying, okay, if you overstimulate the respiratory center, then the next step is what happens to the blood pH. So there, one of them is a cause and effect, and the other one's a feedback loop. That's why they seem very confusing. Yeah. Okay, so with aspirin overdoses, you're going to end up with alkalosis. Technically, it's called respiratory alkalosis. And the reason for this is you're breathing so quickly that you're losing too many what? Too many CO2s, right? So for 5B, the reason for this problem is you're breathing out too many CO2s. And we know the relationship here, carbon dioxide and hydrogens are related. So the more carbon dioxide you breathe out, the more hydrogens you lose as well. And that puts us into a case of alkalosis. Let me just put a note over here. This is cause and effect. And what's on the right side of the board is actually negative feedback control. Let's see, number six, if we have low oxygen levels, hypoxemia, go to our feedback loops. What's our respiratory center going to do about the respiration rate?
Hyperventilate.
Good. So for number six there, the respiratory center responds by hyperventilating. And for 6B, how does this respiration rate change help get you back to normal oxygen levels?
Breathing in more oxygen.
Breathe in more oxygen. Good. So for 6B, we breathe in more oxygen. Let me repeat something I mentioned earlier. If the problem in number six is oxygen and you're breathing faster to get more oxygen in, do you need to talk in your answer about changing pH levels, CO2, or hydrogens? Not at all. They are not the issue, not the problem here. So you would just focus on the problem, and that is breathing faster to get more oxygens into the bloodstream. Okay, so number seven looks like we have another case with lack of oxygen. So for number seven, what was your stimulus? Low oxygen. Good. Number 7A was low oxygen. Looking at our negative feedback loop, how does the respiratory center respond? Hyperventilate. That's right, breathe faster. Kind of an interesting thing to appreciate here, if you have cigarette smoke either secondhand or firsthand in your system, it can impair the amount of oxygen delivery to your brain. So what impact would your brain have if it's exposed to cigarette smoke?
It robs it of the oxygen that it needs to stay alive.
Good, robs it of oxygen, exactly. Okay, for number eight, this is kind of thinking outside our box a little bit. Have you had a chance to work 8, 9, and 10? Not yet. Go ahead.
I have a question on 7.
Sure.
Since it talks about, because you just said, like, don't worry about one if it doesn't talk about the other. Since this talks about carbon monoxide and oxygen, do you include both?
In that case, there's no receptor for carbon monoxide.
Okay.
Just a receptor for oxygen and CO2. So yeah, you wouldn't have to worry about discussing carbon monoxide there.
It's dioxide, not monoxide.
Dioxide, right, not monoxide.
Yeah, okay. All right, I got
you. No, but that's a really good point. It's you're right. You would only have probably one problem at a time to focus on. Yeah. so let's take a look at number 8 there. Number 8 talks about oxygen delivery through a nasal cannula to the nose. And this kind of patient may experience a decreased respiration rate. Why decreased? You're giving them too much, right? So if you're giving somebody too much oxygen, let's find our appropriate feedback loop. If you're giving somebody too much oxygen, then the brain's going to say, oh, we need to breathe slower, and in turn, they hypoventilate. So in fact, you could lower somebody's respiration rate. Now there is a side effect here. The slower you breathe, you keep more what?
CO2
and more hydrogens, right. So there is a negative side effect to this patient getting the oxygen cannula. They may actually get respiratory acidosis from breathing more slowly. Good, okay. Let's take a look at number 9. We've got a neighbor with ketoacidosis, routine events of having high blood sugar. Acidosis is the word I'm looking for there. So what will happen to his respiration rate if he has too many hydrogens in his bloodstream?
He'll hyperventilate.
Yep, so when you walk in and he's hyperventilating, you'll know he's in ketoacidosis and he's having high blood sugar. Does number 9 make sense? Number 10 kind of takes this full circle. Number 10 says, if your respiratory center or system cannot do its job, we've got another backup system to help regulate blood pH. That is your urinary system. Okay, so for number 10, your urinary system or renal system will act as a backup system. I believe in D2L announcements, if you scroll to the bottom, there are another set of these practice problems if you'd like to play with those. And I do have answers up there for you as well. So if you're not feeling quite steady on this, those are probably a good way to practice, get yourself comfortable for the next test. If you need to hear this stuff again, I can certainly hit that topic again come Wednesday. How about questions on page 76? Any one of those you would like me to go back and talk through again? Be glad for me to switch gears, right? So we're going to go on to a different topic. Okay, so on page 77, we're going to talk about gas exchange. And to give you a little bit of background information here about gases, there is a law, another one, called Dalton's Law here on the top of this page. And this particular law talks about the mixture of gases in the air that you breathe. It may come as a surprise that the majority of the gas in the air that we breathe is not oxygen. In fact, the majority of the gas that we breathe in is actually nitrogen gas. So I think oxygen is cut off there on the screen. It says 20.9, around 21% of the air that you breathe is oxygen. You'll notice that nitrogen gas is actually 78% of the air that you breathe. So it is by far the majority of the gas that you breathe. So what Dalton's Law talks about is this. It says if you are thinking about all those gases mixed together in the air that you breathe, each one of those gases is going to represent a partial pressure. So you may notice the mixing of these gases in the animation. Each one of those gases is going to exert its own pressure. Let's go back to this picture here. Which one of these gases do you think is going to exert the most pressure in the mixture that it belongs to? Which one makes up the most percentage?
Nitrogen.
So nitrogen actually carries the most weight, you might say. It's got the most pressure that exerts in the air that you breathe. And the one that exerts the least amount of partial pressure in the air that you breathe is which one?
CO2.
Yeah, CO2. Okay, so when we talk about the pressures exerted by each of these gases, it relies on how much they compose of the air that you breathe. And we call that a partial pressure. And I should mention to you that partial pressure is represented by either a capital P or a lowercase p that's placed in front of the gas. All right, so I'm Sesame Street here for a minute, right? Big P, little p, either one is fine. You can use a big P or a little p in front of your gas. And that tells me the pressure of that gas in the mixture of the air that's being dispensed or whatever you're breathing. All right, so with oxygen being about 21% of the air that you breathe, it doesn't exert a great partial pressure. It's just part of a mixture. Let's take a look at the chart that's next on your page. And on this chart, we're going to ignore nitrogen gas because it's not important except for those who go into deep sea diving. We're going to focus instead on oxygen gas and CO2 gas. You notice that oxygen gas is 21% of the air that you breathe, and it follows a pressure gradient from the outside of your body to your blood and then throughout your body. So it follows from high pressure to low pressure coming into your body. The only numbers you need to know about it are these. In red, you'll notice that normal oxygen levels are 80 to 100 millimeters mercury. So the normal partial pressure of oxygen gas in your bloodstream is 80 to 100 millimeters mercury. You'll notice we get this from an arterial blood gas sample. We call it an ABG for short. You'll also want to know the hypoxia number. It's below 60 millimeters mercury. Okay, so hypoxia means what about your oxygen levels? Too low. Too low, good. Now, let's go back to our feedback loop. If your oxygen levels were too low, what happens to your respiration rate? You're going to hyperventilate, right? So you hyperventilate to help bring in more oxygen. So let me repeat that oxygen is not directly tied to pH, but CO2 is. Okay? CO2 moves in a gradient that's opposite to oxygen. You're making CO2 all the time. You make it in a process to make ATP. So your CO2 moves in a gradient toward your lungs so that you can exhale it out of your body. You'll notice the gradient moves in opposite to what oxygen moves. You'll want to know the normal numbers here. 35 to 45 millimeters mercury is considered normal partial pressure for CO2 in the bloodstream. Likewise, you'll want to know the out of range numbers. The more CO2 you accumulate, the more acidic your bloodstream becomes. So greater than 45 millimeters mercury leads you into a case of respiratory acidosis. Likewise, the less CO2 you have in your bloodstream, the less hydrogens you have, and that leads us to a case of respiratory alkalosis. Let me just remind you what we've talked about in here on Wednesday of last week. When we talk about respiratory gas exchange, we know that in the lungs we perform our first gas exchange, We do load oxygen into the bloodstream, and we unload CO2 from the bloodstream into the air that we're to exhale. We'll talk about CO2 again in just a minute. We'll focus right now on oxygen. So oxygen is going to be our main issue here to carry. And the primary way for us to carry oxygen is bound to hemoglobin. So let me take you back a step into thinking about the hemoglobin structure for just a moment. All right, so tell me what you know about the hemoglobin molecule. Good. It can combine with four molecules of oxygen. And to which particular part does the oxygen bind?
To the heme.
The heme, good. And the heme group has an iron molecule, and that's specifically where your oxygens will bind. So you can bind as many as four oxygens to one hemoglobin for transport. Okay, so that is our magic number there. Four is the max number of oxygens we can transport on a hemoglobin molecule. Now, when oxygen and hemoglobin are bound together, what color does your hemoglobin in your blood turn?
Bright red.
Bright red, good. And we have a name for this. When oxygen and hemoglobin combine together,
oxygen
or oxyhemoglobin. That's it, good, oxyhemoglobin. When oxygen unbinds or disassociates from hemoglobin, what color does your blood turn? Dark red, good. And the name for this is deoxyhemoglobin. Okay, so those terms are down there near the bottom of your page on 77. Let me also draw your attention to the term affinity at the very bottom of the page. So if you have an affinity for salty peanuts, or if you have an affinity for chocolate, or if you like, you know, certain foods, an affinity means that you have a likeness for that particular food. Likewise, oxygen and hemoglobin have an affinity for each other. That means that they have a likeness for each other. When oxygen binds to hemoglobin, we want to encourage four total oxygen molecules to go for a ride. Why four?
Because four is the max that hemoglobin can take.
Good. Four is the max that hemoglobin can take. So if you have four oxygens bound to hemoglobin, we say you have what type of saturation?
100%.
Good. So you're fully saturated. 100% of your hemoglobin has, you know, those oxygens bound. I kind of think of it this way. If you've ever been for a ride in a taxi and you're going by yourself, you're going to foot the entire bill for the taxi ride all by yourself. But if you can get some friends to go along with you and you can fill up every seat in the taxi, then you can split the cost four ways. So it's to your benefit to actually have the maximum number of people ride with you in your taxi cab so you can all split the cost of the ride. So we're looking to maximize the benefit of getting all the seats available on the hemoglobin molecule taken by oxygen. That way we can maximize the number that we transport. If you're transporting anything less than four, what kind of saturation do we have?
Partial.
Partial, yeah. So if you're looking at three, you're at 75% saturation. What if you're only transporting two?
50.
Transporting one is 25%. Of course, zero is no transport. All right, so let me flip you on over to page 78. That's a little easier, right? Brain doesn't hurt so bad. Okay, so what was that word that meant oxygen and hemoglobin liked each other?
Affinity.
An affinity, right. And the max number of oxygens you could transport was how many?
Four.
And that was called what type of saturation?
100%.
100% full saturation, good. And if you have anything less than four, hemoglobin actually changes shape and it says, hey, I've got a seat for, you know, you to ride on. Would you like to ride? And so it kind of makes it easier for us to maximize and get four oxygens bound to the hemoglobin. So that affinity conversation is related to this picture here. Okay, so what this is called the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve, and this is probably better left for fresh brains at the beginning of class. I don't think I'm going to get into this in the last 5 minutes. Why don't we save this for Wednesday? We'll start class with this. If you can look ahead to pages 78 and 79, I think that'll be helpful. I'll see y'all on Wednesday.